Gordon Hayden.
Now, when We Love Movies, we are going to review The Meg, which is the big giant shark film starring Jason Statham. I'd say that was the pitch alone for the film when the producers were meeting with executives trying to get the cash for the film. Well, joining me now from The Herald is Chris Wasser, who has seen the film or endured it. We'll find out now in just a sec. Chris, look, shark movies, just when you think, look, they must be dead and buried at this stage. No, there's such a huge appetite for shark movies. Why do you think that is?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's the fact that, you know, you can go all sci-fi with them, or you can go crazy, preposterous B-movie with them, you know, like the likes of Sharknado, which doesn't seem to have any sort of logic. There are no rules. You can go anywhere with that, or you can do something terrifying, like you know the open water and films like that, where people are stranded in the ocean, and you know, it's genuinely terrifying. Imagine if you were out, you know, lost at sea and surrounded by sharks. That's still scary to a lot of people. You can go the Jaws route, where you're kind of, you know, you have a really strong ensemble of characters and a great screenplay to work with. There are endless routes you could take, but I think the best one here is, and you know, this might have been, as you said, the pitch for The Meg. Why don't we resurrect this prehistoric shark, the Megalodon, and pit him against one of Hollywood's favorite go-to action geezers, Jason Statham? And I'm sure, I think actually this screenplay, because it's based on a novel that's 20 years old, it might have been in development hell for a while, but I'm sure as soon as Jason Statham entered the equation, somebody must have said, sold. Here's $150 million. Go mental.
Because I know at one stage Eli Roth, the director of Cabin Fever and Hostel, yeah, he was attached to it. And then you can think, okay, I can see where they're going there maybe with him, that it's going to be quite vicious. But the director behind it is John Turteltaub. And for those that don't know, he's probably best known for the National Treasure films. And he also made The Sorcerer's Apprentice, the live action version with Nicolas Cage. So then when I thought, okay, they've gone with him to helm it, maybe this is going to be a little bit safer as opposed to a vicious type shark movie.
Yeah, it is. And you know what? I didn't expect to come out of The Meg thinking, wow, that was a fairly, not quite, maybe family friendly. I mean, the 12A series is problematic, and we'll come back to that. But it's a very sanitized shark flick. And I remember reading then afterwards that Eli Roth was connected at one stage, and I thought Eli Roth's version of The Meg would have been, as you say, vicious. He would have gone all out with the gore. It would have been less about maybe the cheesy one-liners. We'll come back to them too. You know, it wouldn't have been, it might have been a more difficult sell with Eli Roth on board. But as I said, there is a big 12A. And I think, you know, that's obviously to help with the opening weekend and the end box office figures. Saying all of this, I did come out of this film very underwhelmed.
Oh, okay. Not that I had massive hopes for The Meg, but you know what? We're going to keep people teased out why you're a little bit underwhelmed, Chris, because first, let's just take a little bit from it.
She's coming.
Oh, boy.
It was the largest shark that ever existed.
Thought to have been extinct for 2 million years.
That thing's out there. We need to find it and kill it.
Why don't you just put a tracker on it? Did you guys ever watch Shark Week?
So, Chris, just before the clip there, we were teased with the fact that you were a little bit underwhelmed by The Meg. How come this didn't live up to expectations? Because you think this should be a bit of a slam dunk. Giant shark movie, Jason Statham doing his Jason Statham shtick. This should be just fun from start to finish. It should be a good, big old, romping action-adventure flick.
It should be. Yeah. I mean, before this was even released, I remember seeing the poster for it. The tagline was chomp on this and opening wide, and the trailer looked like a lot of fun. I thought this could actually be the most ridiculous film of the summer, but also one of the most entertaining. It's Jason Statham versus a 60-foot shark. What is not to like there? The problem is that despite that barmy premise, it ends up taking itself rather seriously. And once it establishes the story, I mean, Jason Statham plays this deep sea rescue diver fella. You know, not a lot of effort has gone into characterization here. But long story short, he had a bad mission. He has a bad mission at the start of the film. He tries to save a bunch of lads on a nuclear sub. A couple of them left behind. And, you know, you probably don't need me to tell you that, you know, once an action man in a film leaves a couple of people behind, it doesn't look well in the CV afterwards. So he kind of, you know, disappears. And 5 years later, you've got this underwater research facility off the coast of China. They're looking into sending down submarines and submersibles, you know, deeper than anyone has ever gone before. Unfortunately, they do go very deep and they're attacked by something. And a crew is stranded, the sub is banjaxed, and one of the crew members is Jonas's ex-wife, that's the character Jason Statham plays. So they have to branch out to him, even though they think he's crazy and even though they think he's drunk now, they need him to save the day. And, you know, long story short, they encounter the Megalodon down there, and it's not too long before the Megalodon comes up. And that's an okay premise. You know, I was on board with it at the beginning. The problem is that once the film establishes that basic setup, I mean, there's two routes you can take here. You can either go big with this or you can go home, because you're talking about a Megalodon shark. This is, you know, the largest shark that ever existed. Long thought to have been extinct but resurrected in this film. You got to go big with this. But the film surprisingly takes a third route, which is that it just ends up splashing around in circles for 2 hours. And there's this real sense that nobody involved is skillful enough to make this a really enjoyable, barmy, ridiculous, almost comedic sci-fi horror film. And on the other side, nobody involved is skillful enough to make it a really clever and sharp satirical horror. And so it just gets lost somewhere in the middle. And, you know, sludgy CGI doesn't help. The fact that Jason Statham, I mean, he's never really on form, is he? He just kind of shows up and, you know, says some cool things, beats up the bad guys, and that's about it. But he just looks a bit lost.
Did you know what this sort of film needed? If we were to imagine that this had come out in the 80s, this to me seems like a film that a young Kurt Russell would have starred in, that has acting chops, also has great charisma, and has that cheeky sense of humour. You need someone like that. And I think Hollywood and films in general are missing an actor of that ilk. They just don't have someone. Statham, he's just a bit too serious. And he's very one note. Like, he has charisma, don't get me wrong, but there's just, when you want to play a bit of humour, I don't think he can really do it.
I don't think so, no. And I think that's, you hit the nail on the head there, that you know, sometimes he takes things a bit too seriously, and this film takes itself far too seriously at times. Just the way it manages, you know, I won't spoil anything, but just the way it kind of approaches some of the deaths of characters, because, you know, people do die here, it kind of gets distracted, and then it focuses on, you know, setting up relationships and, you know, giving Jason Statham's character a girlfriend, and you're like, you know, this is all well and good, but it's not the film we signed up for. Mm. And you're wondering where those sharp, brilliant one-liners are, you know, where are the really coherent action sequences? I mean, there's $150 million pumped into this film from, you know, Chinese film studios and Warner Brothers, and that's an awful lot of money. Why does it look so cheap? And the most disappointing thing, I mean, you could take Statham out of it altogether, you could put in a new cast, it's John Turteltaub's fault that it takes 90 minutes for the shark to approach the Chinese shores, to, you know, to approach beaches, basically, you know, populated by holiday goers and tourists. And that, with the fact that it takes that long, is just unbelievable for me. And then when it gets there, it treats it like an afterthought. And that should be the centerpiece of your film there. A 60-foot shark going straight to, you know, a beach full of hundreds of holiday goers, that should be amazing fun. And it's not.
It just sounds like from the get-go, no one knows what they're at. You know, you've got a great premise there, you know, to have a bit of fun with this massive shark, which is ridiculous, but treat it in a really good blockbuster way. And it sounds like there's too many cooks and they're just spoiling the old broth here. Out of 10, what would you give it, Chris?
I just think it's a shame that, as I say, nobody seems to know what kind of film they want to make here. And it's just, it's probably one of the flimsiest, most forgettable blockbusters of the summer. And I was so looking forward to it. Unfortunately, it's, if you'll excuse the pun, a mega disappointment. So I have to go for 4 out of 10.
And you know what? The thing about August is, though, granted, obviously, we're still in the summer months, but August tends to be a bit of a dumping ground. Once in a while, you know, films come along, like, say, the first Guardians movie. But that was released in August because they still weren't 100% sure how well it was going to do. So it can be a bit of a tester, a little bit of a dumping ground. And movies like The Meg, which aren't necessarily, you know, the top shelf, they can kind of be a bit of the bottom tier, kind of get out, going to get released. So that can always also tell you something about the type of films released this month. Chris will be back a little later on, as we'll be taking a look at the rest of this weekend's new cinema releases.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
But now when We Love Movies, it is time for the movie news. And Andy McCarroll joins me now. Lots to get through, Andy. First of which, though, is the Oscars. Now, next year's ceremony will be pretty much unchanged. But come 2020, it looks like they're going to bow down to the Disney overlords and make some changes, which have taken a lot of people by surprise. So for those that don't know, Andy, what are those changes?
So the Academy now is going to be adding a most popular movie Oscar, which kind of means that the Best Picture Oscar is now unofficially now the Best Unpopular Film of the Year. Like you said, it does feel very much like pandering to Disney. Like they had things like Black Panther made 700 million, was critically acclaimed. And rather than kind of, you know, break the cycle of these kind of, you know, let's face it, films that people aren't going to see and just nominating Black Panther for Best Picture, they've created this whole other category to kind of appease, you know, the larger studios that were making money. Also, you know, the Oscar figures have been down because, you know, to be honest, the films that are being nominated aren't particularly popular. No one really wants, you know, really cares if Shape of Water or Moon Knight is going to win the big award. So I think there's a lot of, you know, the Academy self-preservation trying to pander to the popular crowd now. But I think it's going to create an issue with, I think, quality of film as well, because there's a lot of films that people wouldn't go and see unless they had, you know, buzz around, you know, oh, this film has been nominated for an Oscar, or, you know, this is a lot of Oscar buzz around it. And I think films like, you know, The Shape of Water, like Spotlight or Birdman a couple of years ago, films like that are going to suffer because they're going to get lost in the shuffle of something like, you know, Avengers Infinity War or Black Panther gets nominated for Oscars. They're the ones that they're going to, you know, the studio's really going to get behind and put them at the forefront.
That's a really, really good point, Andy. And the thing is, when I said Disney and why I kind of zoned in on them is because the network in the States in which the Oscars is broadcast, ABC, I think it is, they're owned by Disney, hence why I mentioned that studio. But also as well, Andy, another thing that's been criticised, and I think this now, in fairness, would be fair, is the running time. Like, it's about over 4 hours long. I think last, the Oscars that happened back in late February there, that was way too long. It went over 4.5 hours, something like that. And to be honest with you, I think most people now have got to the stage where, if it's stateside, I couldn't be bothered watching that. I'll just find out the results later on.
Yeah, I think that's what most people do. I think, you know, to be fair to the people who win the technical awards, that's not kind of why you're there. You're there to see, you know, best actor, best actress, best picture, best director. And I think putting the emphasis on them and shortening the runtime is a good idea. I think you need a kind of balance between something like the MTV Awards, which is, you know, really far the other way, where things like Best Kiss, and it's, you know, real blockbuster, and things like the Empire Magazine Movie Awards have this, you know, cracking balance where you'll have, you know, your kind of your Oscar worthy pictures like Phantom Thread would be nominated alongside Black Panther. They're kind of seen as equals as opposed to the divide between the two. Another thing for me, I think the reason behind the decline is if you look at the last 10 years, the Best Picture winners, only one of them, Argo, made over 100 million at the box office. And if you look at the 10 years before that, every single one of them made over 100 million. You had things like The Departed, Lord of the Rings, Gladiator, Titanic, films that, you know, were considered prestige pictures, but also, you know, audiences related with them. And I think because the kind of, you know, the likes of the Marvel movies, the DC films as well are becoming, you know, coming out so quick and fast, Star Wars as well, I put in, you're kind of missing that mid-budget film that, you know, audiences can get behind, your Scorsese films or your historical epics like Gladiator. They're not really making them anymore because they're not having time to build audiences because, you know, next week Avengers or Batman or something is going to come out and just completely blow you out of the water.
Yeah, it's interesting times for the Academy Awards. I just think the whole ceremony needs a little bit of a facelift. When you think of something like the BAFTAs, which is a night where they've got the exact same type of categories, but there seems to be a bit more fun in the air. Look at the Golden Globes. There's a lot of fun in the air there. They're all half, you know, half cut when the ceremonies take place. And it's trying to get it maybe somewhere in between those. It still seems a little bit of a stuffy affair. Some people still feel it's very elitist. And at the same time, some of the films that are getting nominated, people still have issues to a degree, kind of going like, you know, does that really deserve a nomination? But anyway, we could go on and on and on about it all.
You made a great point there as well. Like, when was the last time you saw like an acceptance speech that wasn't, you know, by the numbers, make sure I thank everybody in the industry? Like, no one's, there's nothing memorable to come out of the Oscars. Like, the last thing was probably when La La Land got the Oscar and it was actually meant for Moonlight. Apart from that, you know, it's a very bland and by the numbers. Everything just seems the same and, like you said, very stuffy. I think that was a great point.
Very stuffy. But Andy, we've got some other big news happening this week as well. Johnny Depp, we've been talking about him for some time on the show because we're just taking a step back and going, like, what in the name of good God has gone wrong here? Because this was a man, when you think about him, like in the early days, making the move from 21 Jump Street, the TV series, and then he started, you know, doing great things as this real indie kid, you know what I mean, making these fantastic films and then getting the opportunity to make some reasonable big budget affair like with Edward Scissorhands. You can't blame him for the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie, but by God, did he like taking that paycheck after a while, and because of that, it sort of came, it became his undoing as well, because he had more money than sense. And at the moment, Andy, one of his films has been pulled from release. There's talk of him doing another Pirates film. Somebody just needs to sit him down because, Andy, it just seems like it's getting from bad to worse with him. And of course, we've also had the Rolling Stone article, which painted him in a very unfavourable light as well.
Yeah, and we'd spoken previously before. I think that we both kind of agreed the last film that we'd say, you know, Johnny Depp was fantastic in and was a good film was Blow. And that was 17 years ago. It was 2001. And it's kind of easy to, you know, Jesus, how quickly that's after passing that he's kind of slid into mediocrity. You've said there City of Lies is about the murders of Tupac and Biggie Smalls. There's actually a TV show at the moment called Unsolved with Josh Duhamel from Las Vegas, kind of covering the same thing. And this film now has been kind of taken off the slate. It was supposed to be released before the end of the year. And one of the studios come out and said, with the climate around Depp as it is right now, we're going to hold back until, you know, the situation kind of sees itself out. Johnny Depp hit back and said he was going to sue, you know, everybody involved for, you know, tarnishing his name. The studio then came back and said, well, to be honest, the reason we're doing this is because Johnny Depp has actually had an assault case filed against him by one of the production staff. Their shooting permits had expired. Johnny Depp got really angry and punched one of the actors and one of the producers on the set. So they were kind of keeping that under wraps, obviously, because they didn't want, you know, negative publicity on their film. But when Johnny Depp started talking lawsuits, they kind of said, look, the reason we're stopped is because of you. It's not because of us.
Oh, God, the gloves are off. And look, he's had a lot of personal problems in his life as well, of course, with the his relationship with Amber Heard, which did not end well. There's still an awful lot in regard to that. And there was even a petition as well, Andy, to try and get him off the Harry Potter prequel, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Now, that's still set for release. You can't imagine a juggernaut like that being pulled from the release schedules as well, because they're really hoping that people might see the character as opposed to Johnny Depp. But it's very disappointing, and the fact that he's even thinking about another Pirates of the Caribbean film just to kind of goes to show you, the man now seems to be a bit desperate, it seems. But looking at other movie news, Andy, it was announced this week there's going to be a Batwoman TV series now. We're also going to see Supergirl movie is going to happen. Is this going to have any bearing on the TV series, though?
No, this is going to be completely separate. The same, DC are doing the same thing with Marvel. They're keeping their TV universe separate from the cinematic one. And they've built up, you know, things like Arrow, Supergirl, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow. They've built their, you know, a huge kind of dynasty now on TV. And the cinema is trying to replicate that now. I heard a few mumblings during the week that Henry Cavill is the Man of Steel sequel. It's been cancelled and he might be kind of being slowly ushered off. So it seems that DC's focus now is going to be very much based on the female superheroes. They've got Wonder Woman 2, Birds of Prey coming, and now Supergirl is the latest one that's been given the green light. It's going to be directed by Aaron Ozzel, who's currently in the middle of shooting the Sonic the Hedgehog live-action movie, which I'm very curious to see. And they're kind of looking at making this a standalone and, you know, going by the Marvel model where they do individual films, building up to a team up then, as opposed to what they did with Justice League, where kind of threw everything together and we can see the kind of mess that made.
No, that's an absolute mess. I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of course correction going along behind the scenes at DC at the moment, because look, they had already committed to Aquaman, so the train was already in motion there. Wonder Woman, they know they've really got something there. That Aquaman looks awful. The trailer too.
Yeah, they've also come out with Aquaman and said as well that they're not going to be, there's going to be no other links to any other members of the Justice League. So I think very much they're trying to separate everybody now and see what works and what doesn't before they mush them all together again.
I think so. Like someone was saying to me, I have not read this comic book, but for fans of it, they'll know full well. Flashpoint, is a one in which they could kind of do a bit of a Days of Future Past, where they can go back and they can really mess with the timeline, and even it would allow new actors to take on some of the signature roles within the DC world. So that could be a way to try and fix things with the
Flashpoint
story.
Yeah, and it's interesting
story.
That they've pushed Flashpoint back as well. Flashpoint was supposed to be the next one. And I think you're dead right in what you're saying there. I think the reason they've pushed that back is we're going to release a couple of solo films, see what works, and then we'll have Flashpoint, you know, reboot, you know, maybe take Affleck and take Cavill off the board and replace them with somebody else.
Ah, yes. Look, Ben Affleck is sleepwalking his way through Batman at the moment, and I love him. You know what I mean? I think he's a really good Bruce Wayne, but you could see by him, he has that look in his eyes of a man going, why am I here? It's not working. I'm not a fan of Henry Cavill. I really don't. I just don't see him as a strong Superman. But anyway, Andy, finally, just before we head into the break, James Gunn, we've been talking about this as well, about him being fired by Disney. There was an awful lot of talk, would he get reinstated? That's not going to happen. But there's still the issue of the script, because he has written the Volume 3. Is that going to be kept? Is he still going to be on board? Or are they going to just throw that out and then start anew?
Yeah, there was two kind of interesting bits from this. The first was, you know, James Gunn is gone. We don't want anything to do with him. It's disgraceful. And then Disney went, actually, the script is pretty good. We're going to hang on to this. And hopefully nobody reads the screenplay credits in the film. Another thing that kind of came out as well today is that James Gunn hasn't actually been fired yet. They're still in the process of negotiating his release. Now, he'd been hired to write and direct Guardians of the Galaxy. He's still under contract, essentially, for that. That hasn't been changed. The thing is, they could still turn around and say, especially off the back of, you know, Dave Bautista saying he doesn't want anything to do with it if they don't shoot the script, the cast, of course, coming out with that letter. I think there's still a few twists and turns to this. Even if Gunn is, you know, they stick to their guns, for want of a better term, and let him go, he's contracted for $10 million, but if he's released, he still gets $7 million. So I don't know if they're going to, I know Disney has all the money in the world, are they going to pay somebody essentially $7 million to not make a film for them? Especially with, there's rumours this week as well that DC are waiting in the wings to snatch them off their hands and give James Gunn the keys to the DC kingdom.
Wouldn't that be interesting? I know there's John Campy, a popular YouTuber, he suggested how great it would be for James Gunn to take on Green Lantern, like the Green Lantern Corps film.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
That'd be a perfect fit, wouldn't it? Andy McCarroll, thank you so much. Andy's going to be back in part two of We Love Movies. We're talking shark movies off the back of the release of The Meg. Plus, we'll be going through the other new cinema releases out this weekend. That's all to come in part two of We Love Movies.